Please be seated.
All right, we'll reconvene. Defense, are you ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Rowan, honorable judges of this court, I'm Captain Tom Smith, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Wells, we represent the appellee in this case, Staff Sergeant Ronnie Mobley. May it please the court. On the 7th of May, 2013, during a press conference that occurred after the preferral of charges in this case, but before the referral of charges, our Commander-in-Chief made the statement that anyone found engaging in sexual assault has got to be court-martialed and dishonorably discharged, period.
Counsel, let me ask you right now. How do you pass the preamble to Article 37 and Article 37 applies to, and Article 13 is the commanding officer includes only commissioned officers? How do you pass that preamble to the CMJ and Article 37 applies to the President of the United States?
Excuse me. Well, first, Your Honor, the appellee concedes that the President is not mentioned in Article 37 specifically. And unless he's the general court-martial convening authority, we agree that the clear statutory language of Article 37 doesn't appear to include the President. However, such a reading of Article 37 produces the absurd result that the President can make a statement like this and be immune from an analysis of unlawful command influence.
Well, what do you mean there are different legal theories under due process to put Article 37? You're saying we should apply Article 37 to handle what you do under due process?
Your Honor, I think both would be appropriate. But Article 37, as this Court brought up in the government's argument in the Hutchins case, I think that that Judge Ryan and Chief Judge Baker's opinions in those cases are instructive that the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has in the past applied an Article 37 analysis to senior civilian members in the military hierarchy, and Chief Judge Baker cited a number of cases in his dissent showing that. He mentioned United States versus Allen, United States versus Estrada, U.S. v. Fowle, and U.S. v. Doherty. And I believe all those cases involved the Secretary of the Navy and a zero-tolerance policy either with regard to drugs or with regard to sexual assault. And in those cases, trial counsel attempted to introduce those policies, those written directives from the Secretary of the Navy into evidence in a court-martial, and in those cases, it was the Court of Military Appeals held that that would be unlawful command influence to allow those to come into a court-martial.
I think there's a distinction of the trial and evidence. I don't ask you a question now, because I intend to ask the government this argument. You need to answer it. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, the court would determine that Article 37 does not apply to the President because it's plain language, but instead there is a due process requirement that would apply to the President or other civilian officials. What would be the standard of review under that? Obviously, you say the government has to, if the defense raises some evidence, the government would have to determine evidence beyond reasonable doubt. If we're not under Article 37, but we're under a due process standard, instead, is the defense's initial burden different, and is the government's burden after?
Your Honor, I think it should be the same standards that should be applied. I think the military judge explained this well in his ruling, and it may not have been in his ruling, excuse me, I believe in the transcript. He talked about this on the record and said that unlawful command influence existed before the creation of Article 37. And I think because unlawful command influence existed before the creation of Article 37, it should be treated as unlawful command influence, even if, in this case, the President, who's not specifically mentioned in Article 37, it should still be applied to him, and the same analysis should also apply as well. Because unlawful command influence, whether you're looking at under Article 37 or just as the concept of unlawful command influence, I think it should be treated the same way.
Let me step in there just to go ahead and guide your thoughts here. You know, that test, I can't pronounce it, I apologize, for UCI requires as a predicate matter that the defense raise some evidence of UCI. Can you define for us what some evidence means, how it's been interpreted by other cases? Does it have to reflect back to your particular case, or is it just a general comments made of UCI that are sufficient to meet the defense's burden to then give it over to the government? So a lot of questions there.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe this is the case where there is some evidence of UCI. We have a statement from the president that the military judge said can at least be interpreted as a directive. It applies to all instances of sexual assault in the military. It's clear from the context of the president's statement that he was addressing all cases of sexual assault. It's different than the Aberdeen Proving Ground cases. He wasn't addressing specifically Lackland Air Force Base. He was addressing sexual assault and the problem of sexual assault in the military. That's the logical connection in this case. Some evidence is obviously the president's statement, and also the statement from the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, as well as his action of bringing all the wing commanders in the Air Force to Washington, D.C. to watch the Invisible War. And what was the command message that came with the watching of that?
Well, what's wrong with the Chief of Staff or the President saying, we need to take this seriously. We need to bring our wing commanders in to make sure that they are taking allegations of sexual assault seriously. It affects good order and discipline, and I expect all my wing commanders to ensure they do what they can to appropriately handle allegations of sexual assault. What is wrong with that command message?
Your Honor, there's nothing wrong. I mean, even the military judge in his ruling said that there's nothing wrong in and of itself with requiring the watching of the documentary, The Invisible War. As he said in his ruling, he was more concerned with what was the accompanying command message that came with the watching of that.
And what evidence do we have of what that accompanying command message was?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, we don't have any evidence of what that accompanying command message was.
So we assume it's a bad message? I mean, it wouldn't lie to that.
Your Honor, I think you have to look at, and I think this is what the military judge did, is you have to look at the context as well. And the context is that previously the Chief of Staff of the Air Force had said before the Senate that he would like to see stiffer punishments for sexual assault offenses, even minor offenses. So given that context, I believe that's some evidence that the Chief of Staff of the Air Force required all the wing commanders to come and watch the Invisible War. We don't know specifically what that command message was. That could have been clarified, but it wasn't. But I don't think it's that large of a jump given the context that surrounds that action by the Chief of Staff.
And so who is the burden of proving what that command message was? Is that on the defense?
The burden would be on the government, Your Honor, to prove I'm sorry?
Why?
If the burden has shifted to the government to prove that that situation did not constitute some evidence of UCI, then the burden is on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that didn't create the appearance of unlawful command influence, or that there was no actual unlawful command influence.
So you just have a movie, you have this message, you show these pilot messages, you have some evidence at that point, don't you need to know that
message? Your Honor, I think it would be more important if we were talking about actual UCI, which I think here, because the military judge found that the command message accompanying the watching of the Invisible War was apparent UCI, I think you have to look at it in that context of looking at the whole, does that, along with the Chief of Staff's earlier comments, raise some evidence of unlawful command influence? And I think, given that context, that shifts the burden into the government to prove that there was no UCI here. They could have called witnesses, they could have dealt with this in a different way to dispel that appearance of unlawful command influence beyond a reasonable doubt, but they chose not to.
Counsel, let me ask you, how is this different than, say, the Chief of Staff recommended we move it? And the defense counsel from now on gets to look at every book in the Chief of Staff's reading list and say, because this book contains this message and the Chief of Staff has recommended that all officers and all military members read this book, and therefore that's some evidence of UCI, government burden is now on you.
Your Honor, I think it would depend on what the book said. I think the case law is clear that even the Simpson case, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces said that we have to take every case on a case-by-case basis. So I think to answer your question, it would depend on what the book said. If the book said, I expect more severe punishments in sexual assault cases, even minor sexual assault cases, or I expect prosecutions and dishonorable discharges for all sexual assault cases, then yes, I think that would meet that burden, Your Honor.
Counsel. Does it not matter who the audience or who the target audience or who the listener is?
Yes, Your Honor, to some extent that provides some context and can be important in a determination of whether or not there's UCI.
And you were going down the road of a parent. UCI. So who's the listener? Who's the target audience? Who's our litmus test to determine whether or not there is apparent UCI?
I believe it would be a reasonable member of the public who's familiar with the facts of the case. I believe that includes context, not only would a reasonable observer aware of the facts, the President's statement, the Chief of Staff's statement, the fact that the Chief of Staff had everybody watch, the wing commanders watch the Invisible War and what that command message was, would a reasonable observer knowing those things, knowing the contextual things that the military judge cited as well, would they believe that there is no taint of unlawful command influence in this case?
Well, let's get back to some of the facts. What are the facts that the observer needs to be fully informed of? Isn't it that we have a two-star general who has 20-some years of service and has been a commander so many times and has vast experience in preferring and referring and taking action in courts martials? Isn't that relevant as well?
Yes, Your Honor, but I believe it's also relevant to look at being a general and knowing that there are general officers whose promotions have been held up because of decisions. I believe that's a contextual thing to consider. So someone looking in on this process might say, I don't believe that an affidavit or a memorandum is sufficient to overcome the appearance of unlawful command influence.
So your position is that the President's comments and the comments made by the Chief then would apply to any case of sexual assault out there. I mean, there doesn't have to be any tie to the particular case that's being tried. It's just it applies uniformly to all cases of the sexual assault nature. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. The President's comments were given in a directive manner, and it was the President's promise to the public that this is how we're going to handle sexual assault cases. And given that the President was addressing all sexual assault cases, then yes, I believe that the President's comments, the Chief of Staff's comments regarding the need for stiffer punishments apply to all sexual assault cases.
Well, where's the prejudicial impact to your client? Because one of the Biagi factors is that the proceedings were unfair and that the UCI was a cause of that unfairness. So where's the unfairness that you're able to show in this case? The mere fact that the mere fact that charges were brought is unfair?
Your Honor, the prejudice is that the appellee in this case is entitled to a court-martial free from the taint of unlawful command influence. That taint has not been removed, at least the appearance of that taint has not been removed from the referral process.
But our Superior Court has said that one of the tests that defense must show in meeting their burden is that the proceedings were unfair and that the UCI was the cause of that unfairness. The Agassi was the one that set those standards. So the way I read that, it seems that CAF is requiring more than mere allegations or a command, you know, in the air that there's something going on. It requires some connection back to the individual case at bar to show that those comments somehow improperly influenced that court-martial. And where is the evidence that that occurred in this case?
Well, it sounds like you're talking more with regard to actual unlawful command influences.
I'm reading what CAF said, the factors they laid out.
Your Honor, the prejudice would be, was the referral in this case affected by the President's comments and the Chief of Staff's comments and actions?
And what evidence do you have that it was?
The evidence is all within the appearance, Your Honor. And even the military judge, in finding actual unlawful command influence, even said even in the absence of actual unlawful command influence, there is at least the appearance. And that's why I've been focusing more on the appearance of unlawful command influence, because it's much more pervasive and much more difficult to eradicate.
And on the issue of apparent UCI, so is it the defense's position that the government simply did not do enough here to meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Or is it the defense position that, given the comments that were made and the pervasive and the widespread nature of them, that the government could not have met its burden under any circumstances here? To ask it slightly differently, what was the government supposed to do? Was merely calling the convening authority and proving to the military judge that this particular convening authority was not affected, would that be enough to cure the appearance issue? Or is there something required beyond that?
If the general court-martial convening authority had testified, Your Honor, I believe that would have gone a long way toward potentially curing. Whether it would have effectively cured unlawful command influence, even the appearance of unlawful command influence, we don't know. And part of the reason we don't know is because in his affidavit, the general court-martial convening authority raised some more questions and muddied the waters even further in his what the judge called a memorandum. He referred to comments by the Secretary of Defense and many other high-ranking civilian military officials regarding sexual assault in the military. He said he was aware of additional comments that the military judge had not even put in issue.
You can't take those statements as to the General Commercial Convening Authority's awareness of these other statements. You can't kind of surgically extract them from the context in which they appear, because he says any comments by superior government officials, both civilian and military, have had no impact on my decision-making as a convening authority. When I referred this case to trial, selected members, or took any action in this case, I made my decisions in accordance with the Uniform Code of Military Justice and rules for court-martial. I took my role as the convening authority for this case very seriously. You know, how do you respond to government counsel's suggestion that this train left the station and it was going to go, the military judge was going to rule this way irrespective of what the government had produced thus far? And particularly in light of the one line in the military judge's ruling that I found a little bit puzzling. While this court could conclude that the GCMCA's memorandum is both honest and earnest, it doesn't address the principal issues. Blah, blah. You know, the principal issues presumably referred to above, where the memo is already that says, I'm aware of all this stuff. I take my role seriously. I didn't consider any of it. Here we go. And essentially, you got the military trial judge saying, even if I assume it's honest and earnest, it wouldn't be enough.
I'm just curious for your thoughts. I realize that's a bit of an imprecisely defined question. That, you know, your opponent said this train left the station and it was gone. How do you respond to that?
And I think the military judge addressed that. He cited the case of United States versus Kitchens, which is a Court of Military Appeals case from 1961. And in that case, there was a letter from a staff judge advocate to, it was a very broad letter, I think it was widely distributed, and several members on that court-martial received a copy of that letter. And even though during voir dire they said that this letter won't affect them, and the letter called for a bad conduct discharge. Even though they said that letter wouldn't affect them, they gave a bad conduct discharge, and the Court of Military Appeals said in that case that sometimes someone doesn't even know that they've been affected. And in that case, they said, we're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the accused in that case, and we're going to find that that did not fix the appearance of unlawful command influence. And I think that's analogous to this case. In that case, it was whether or not the members were affected, but in this case, it's whether the referral process was affected by the president and his comments and by the chief of staff. Even though the general court-martial convening authority says in his memorandum that he wasn't affected, I think the Kitchens case is, the military judge cited this in his ruling, it is instructive in that that doesn't really dispel the appearance of unlawful command influence. Would an outside observer, knowing, after having seen that affidavit or memorandum, however you choose to look at it, would that dispel the appearance of unlawful command influence to an outside observer, knowing that that general is probably aware that other generals' promotions have been held up?
Well, let's take that one step further. You know, let's say 2 years ago we had a rape case and that was taken to court. A year ago we had a rape case and that was taken to court. Now the president comes out with comments and we have another rape case and that's taken to court. Is really an observer looking at that thinking, oh, the only reason you're here is because of the president's comments?
I think given the mantle of command authority that the president carries, and given that person that is looking in on this case clearly would have to have knowledge, if they have knowledge of the facts and circumstances, also would have to have knowledge of the culture in the military. And the culture in the military is, if my commander-in-chief says, I expect consequences, I want court martials and dishonorable discharges, a reasonable observer would think, okay, a general sending a case to a court martial in order to please the president might, instead of dismissing those charges or referring them to a special court martial or some other type of disposition, sends them to a general court martial where a dishonorable discharge is available.
Well, true, but if you had a case that was, let's say, something we handled with an Article 15 or a special court, and now it's in a general court, maybe you'd have an argument, but something that's always been a general court martial, how is an outside observer going to sit there and say, oh yeah, the only reason we're here is because of something that the president said or something that the chief of staff said?
Your Honor, I believe you have to look at the context as a whole, all the facts and circumstances. Was this case already destined to go to a general court-martial? I don't think that's necessarily a fair assumption. Each case has to be reviewed on its own individual facts and circumstances. And given the context of the president, not only the president's comments, but the environment in which generals are reviewed for promotion propriety, based on what they potentially do in sexual assault cases, I don't believe a reasonable observer would conclude that just because Major General Bender said I wasn't affected meets the high burden of beyond a reasonable doubt.
But if he was so overborne by the president and the chief's comments, then why did he dismiss the specification that he did after the IO recommended that it not go forward? I mean, there it seems that he's applying his own independent judgment with respect to what to do to this case before him and not as a result of concern about presidential comments or anything else.
Your Honor, I can't answer that. I wish that had been answered by Major General Bender if he testified. I think a lot of these things would have been cleared up if the government hadn't negligently failed to meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's, the government complains of how can we possibly address all these allegations in an affidavit? The answer is simple. You call the general court martial convening authority to testify, and then he can address all of the issues.
You make a good point there. How are we to address that, you know, the next morning issue where essentially the government said, hey, we're ready to do that? And the trial judge said, no, never mind. How, if at all, should that factor into our decision? I mean, should that be an issue we analyze? And if so, pursuant to what theory? Is it an abuse of discretion? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that should be reviewed under the standard of an abuse of discretion. The military judge cited the case of U.S. v. Harrison. That case gives the military judge the discretion whether or not to grant reconsideration and whether or not to take additional evidence.
He also dropped a footnote that referenced judicial economy and the importance of hearing both sides and making sure everything, and substantively took issue with the fact that the specific allegations were not addressed, but when presented with the opportunity to achieve precisely that result, said no thanks.
Yes, Your Honor. He pointed out that if he did that, he was afraid he would just be furthering the appearance of unlawful command and influence by giving the government essentially a second bite at the apple. He just told them how their case was deficient. If he now grants them an opportunity to perfect their case, he's now potentially furthered the appearance of unlawful command influence.
Then why didn't he kick it with prejudice? Yeah. I mean, he gave a second opportunity to go back and answer these questions.
It seems to me a distinction without much of a meaningful difference.
And the military judge weighed the benefit and the prejudice to each side in making that decision. Dismissal without prejudice didn't so prejudice the government that it couldn't find a way to potentially cure these defects in unlawful command influence. But it also, by allowing them to reconsider, he would be greatly prejudicing the appellee in this case.
But the standard that the judge applied, here, and this is reading from the record, would an individual sitting on the outside believe that the simple act of calling General Bender to the stand to remedy a shortfall in the government's evidentiary presentation before this court, in light of the importance of the issue, be viewed fairly? An individual sitting on the outside, I think we have to be careful about who, again, going back to my previous question about who the target audience, who the witness is for. It is not for somebody sitting out reading the Washington Post. That's not the standard. Correct? The standard is an objective, disinterested observer, fully informed of all the facts and circumstances, and would they then have a significant doubt as to the fairness of the proceeding. Do you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. If I misspoke earlier and gave you the impression that wasn't the standard, then...
Well, the judge has applied the standard that it's just Joe Public sitting out at the bus stop reading the Washington Post. And what would they think? And that is not who the court has said is important in an apparent UCI.
I think what the distinction is in reconsideration, what would a member, what would an outside observer think upon looking in after having ruled that the government failed to meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I think just heightens the appearance of unlawful command influence by now giving the government a second chance to fix its case. I believe that's what the military judge was trying to say there.
But he did offer a second chance. He dismissed without prejudice.
I'm not sure if I understand Your Honor's question then.
He dismissed charges without prejudice. The government has a second chance to go back and start from ground zero and hear this case all over again, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but that would also potentially be litigated again as well.
Well, it's still going to be litigated then if they call them to the stand the next morning. I think what we're struggling with...
If he applies the same standard, which is a much broader standard than the standard the court has given us, we're going to be right back here again.
Yes, Your Honor.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the judge's concern was he didn't want to say one afternoon, now here's how your case is deficient, but not, well, wink, wink, if you fix that tomorrow morning, we'll be good to go. He wanted to avoid that appearance because it would have, you know, sort of placed them back in the same situation. I think what some of us are asking is, but we're kind of back in the same situation anyway because he dismissed without prejudice.
But, Your Honor, the government doesn't have to refer charges in this case. And the government can take steps in the meantime between the dismissal of charges without prejudice and re-referral to attempt to cure the appearance of unlawful command influence. This court mentioned during the government's argument a memo from the Secretary of Defense. One could argue that that is one step toward attempting to cure the appearance of unlawful command influence from the President's comments. It's the government's choice whether or not to re-refer charges against the appellee if this court upholds the military judge's dismissal. And by denying reconsideration, or if he had granted reconsideration, there just isn't that time that the government has upon a dismissal without prejudice to attempt to cure those defects. I believe that's the difference.
Counsel, let me ask you, do you believe that the military judge abuses discretion in the remedy that he here is being part of the general policy of the issue of the investigation? And but you find a problem with referral, but rather than just saying find a referral to be automatic, or whether he's sent back to essentially the post-32 pre-referral stage, he dismisses the whole case without prejudice, even those parts of the procedure of the case that he found the problem with. And how, why is that valid?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if I see the actual effectual difference between the two.
Well, the effectual difference is this decision stands, the government has to proceed from the beginning of the case again. Referral, they choose to do so, Article 32, and then referral. Whereas here, the trial judge only got policy for referral, so why didn't it just simply invalidate the referral? And let the case proceed from there.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. What I can tell you, Your Honor, is that in the military judge's ruling, he said that the defense didn't object to the validity of the Article 32 hearing. He found no problems with the Article 32 hearing. I don't know the answer to Your Honor's question.
I'll ask one more time just because I'm still not quite sure I understand. Where does the prejudice to your client with respect to the comments made by either the President or the convening, or excuse me, the Chief of Staff, as to how it unfairly influenced this case? What evidence do we have that the convening authority took action, or the preferral authority took action as a result of those comments when they affirmatively stated in their various affidavits that those did not influence their decision? How was your client prejudiced?
Your Honor, if you could point me to the case that you're referencing, that
it was Biagassi, if I think I finally pronounced that right. And as I said, I was reading, it looks to be Biagassi 50MJ at 150, where at the appellate level, we must evaluate UCI in the context of a completed trial. Granted, this is not a completed trial, but they say using the following factors. The defense must show facts which, if true, constitute UCI. Two, show that the proceedings were unfair. And three, show that the UCI was the cause of the unfairness. So I'm reading straight what CAP has laid out. Seems to have an indication that that is supposed to look back to the case at bar and say, how was your client, how was this accused unfairly prejudice as a result of that UCI? That's what I'm asking. What evidence do we have of that unfairness? Not that the comments were made, I got that. How was it unfair?
Your Honor, the President's comments appear to be a directive directing not only prosecution but dishonorable discharge. Those are the facts which, if true, and they're uncontested by the government. The government only contests whether or not those constitute unlawful command influence.
So how does the convening authority or the preferral authority ever counter that, except to say, yeah, I heard them, but those didn't influence my decision? Is that not enough for them to say that?
It would depend on the circumstances, Your Honor. In this case, there just wasn't enough to rebut the appearance of unlawful command influence. The issue is not so much in the appellate's position what the actual prejudice was. If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, you're asking what prejudice was there. I don't think there necessarily has to be prejudice in order for there to be unlawful command influence. The prejudice is whether or not the accused gets a fair trial or has the appearance of a fair trial. That's the prejudice. If you're asking for something, am I misunderstanding Your Honor?
I'm simply referring to what CAF has laid out in that test. Now, other cases, if we refine that, then please let me know. But the second step is that the proceedings were unfair. I read that to say the proceedings are your proceedings or your client's proceedings, and that they were unfair. So something about that UCI had to influence your client's case. And I'm just asking what that may be in this case.
I think that reference right there, Your Honor, is referring to actual unlawful command influence. I don't think what the court is saying there is you have to show... Let me put it this way, Your Honor. The proceedings were unfair because the appearance was that the general court martial convening authority may have referred charges in this case because of the president's comments and the chief of staff's comments and actions.
But what is, going back to, I guess, the same question, I don't mean to keep harping on this, but I guess I do want to ask it one more time. Unfairness to me says that the reason we're in court, the reason that this guy was, this accused was charged, was because of the president's comments. What is the evidence that that's the reason that we're here versus, you know, just this convening authority who says in his affidavit that I did the same thing I always do. I looked at it, I independently made a judgment. It was one charge that he did, so, you know, he independently listened to the I.O., followed the I.O.'s recommendation. So this court-martial is no different than any other court-martial that we ever had, despite the fact these comments were made. So how is that unfair?
Your Honor, I have to go back to the appearance of unlawful command influence.
Well, where's the appearance that it's unfair? Just because it's said that's appearance and that's your, I mean, is that what your position is?
Your Honor, I guess I would just point this court to the standard that the burden on the defense to raise some evidence of unlawful command influence is low.
Okay, I get that, but now the government has put out evidence saying, look, from this convening authority, I didn't do anything different than what I've done before. So what we're looking at the end of the day, we have to find that there's something about this proceeding that's unfair, according to this CAF case here. If that's true, what is the unfairness in this court martial? How is this particular accused facing charges unfair?
Your Honor, he's potentially facing charges unfairly because we don't know whether there was, in fact, I mean, the burden shifted to the government, and the government has negligently failed to show that there is no unlawful command influence. It all goes back to the appearance of unlawful command influence.
Well, I think the government, I understand the issue. So your position is the government didn't do this, even though what the government's, I think, claiming is, look, this convening authority did what he does in every case. He follows the UCMJ, he refers, he picks members. He didn't do anything different about this. So, he was aware of these comments, but that had nothing to do with what was happening in this particular case. I looked at this case just like I look at every other case, and I referred it to court based upon the recommendation, you know, arguably, of the IO, which apparently he followed because he dismissed one of the charges. So, I'm asking, how is that... What's different about this case?
Your Honor, I think the distinction is the President's comments. In previous cases, the President's comments had not been made yet. Now that the President's comments have been made, a reasonable, disinterested observer would have a question whether or not, in this case, was the convening authority affected. And even if even if there is an actual unlawful command influence, there's
still... Wouldn't secretaries be in every sexual assault case from here on out?
Yes, Your Honor, I think arguably it is, unless some type of remedial action is taken by the president or senior military officials to clarify what the president said, what the chief of staff meant.
So wasn't that done the very day that the judge's decision was made?
But, Your Honor, that, I believe you're referring to the memo by the Secretary of Defense.
I am.
That's not on the record in this case, Your Honor. And that took place after the referral in this case.
But it could have been in the reconsideration, correct?
Your Honor, if one of the parties had put that into evidence, potentially, yes.
So how do you say that? Go
ahead. You said it all the time, the government negligently failed to present evidence to meet their burden. And how does that mean that they should call the immunity authority as a witness?
Yes, Your Honor.
That, Your Honor, what could the immunity authority have said other than what was in the affidavit or the state document there? And he said,
Your Honor, I don't know specifically what he would have said, but I think some of the things he would have had to have addressed were whether or not he did go and watch the Invisible War, and he would have been able to explain, if he had, what the command message was that accompanied that. His affidavit doesn't even address the statements from the chief of staff calling for more severe punishments for sexual assault offenses. So he could clarify, if he had testified, whether he was in fact aware of that specific statement and whether or not that affected him. He mentioned several other statements in his affidavit.
Well, wait, it's not a word, all these things, none of them happened. So, I mean, that's kind of a line of defense. I mean, the defense obviously doesn't have heard of this, but they don't call him because they will want to be with this and cross-examine him about specifically what he heard and what that had. In this case, he's basically got a blanket statement of everything I've heard about sexual assault. None of that's had an impact. I made my decision here, so I just wonder if you say there's something more that could have done or another way to tell him, what could be said or have you seen every one of these cases? Is it just there's no law command to say someone, there's nothing anybody can say if you want to do that?
And if, let me just add to that, apparently the statement, a similar statement, was again good enough for the referral authority to satisfy the judge and for the government to satisfy the reasonable doubt standard. And I think you need to answer both those questions. Judge Reed has answered that question.
And to answer Your Honor's question, the referral took place before the president's statement. So there's a distinction there. Referral standard is different than the referral standard. The military judge found that the affidavit, which in that case was a true affidavit from the referring commander, was sufficient.
Let me ask you, what is the standard for referral? What's the
problem with
that?
It is that a commander be have reasonable belief that a crime has been committed and that the accused likely committed that crime.
And how is that happening?
Your Honor, I think this all goes back to the appearance of unlawful command influence. I hate to...
So are you conceding there was no actual unlawful command influence, or are we still on the but he didn't realize it theory?
I'm not conceding that the military judge was incorrect in finding that there was potentially actual unlawful command influence. We just don't have evidence disproving actual unlawful command influence.
Other than General Officer's signed statement that he didn't let that infect.
In that regard, Your Honor, I would bring your attention back to U.S. v. Kitchens that the military judge cited. I think the reason I'm focusing more on apparent unlawful command influence is it's more difficult to eradicate. Even if there is no actual unlawful command influence, the appearance has to be dealt with and has to be overcome by beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the government's burden.
I just want to make sure we're not imprecisely glossing over stuff. And I'm not suggesting you're doing that. But I thought I heard you say, and there's no evidence, and I don't want to lose the point that Judge Pelequin made on the evidence that would be in possession of the person informed of all the evidence in the case and aware of the proceedings would be this signed statement from the general officer who referred the case. I just want to make sure we didn't lose that.
I'm not sure if I understand.
I'm sorry, that wasn't a question.
That's what I wasn't sure.
But you didn't answer his question. Is this actual or just apparent, or both?
You have to believe it's both, and that's what the military judge found, and it's up to this court to decide whether or not the military judge erred in finding that there was both actual and apparent unlawful command.
But what he's asking you is, what is your opinion of the actual evidence in this case?
To answer your honest question, there is a what appears to be a directive statement from the commander-in-chief. Given Article 92, Article 80 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, I think that is evidence right there that of actual and lawful command influence. Unless Major General Bender were to testify and say, I'm aware of the, I did not think this was a directive, I did not interpret the President's comment that way, I was not affected. I think that is the hurdle that the government failed to meet. They didn't call him to testify and explain what was the context he heard that statement. And the military judge addresses this in his ruling. You have to look at the context that the hearer is receiving this message. What was the context that he received that message? Did he interpret it as a directive or not? And was there actual unlawful command influence?
But at the end of the day, the question is really Judge Mitchell's, isn't it? You know, which was the crux of the argument on unlawful command influence is we wouldn't be in court unless the two-star general felt threatened to refer the case. So in your evaluation of the evidence presented to the two-star general, is it wanting? And if so, how?
It's one thing given the context, and I believe I'm out of time, Your Honor. Your Honor, you have to look at, this goes back to apparent unlawful command influence. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances. Given the environment where generals are unsure whether or not they're going to be promoted if they make the wrong decision on a sexual assault case, and given the lack of proof from the government, this case is as much of a lack of proof on the government's part as it is an apparent unlawful command influence case. So given the context of this case, a reasonable observer could conclude that there is apparent unlawful command influence, if not actual, and that hasn't been proven or eradicated beyond a reasonable doubt by the government.
Now, what is your position as to what the test for apparent UCI is? Is it that a reasonable observer, fully informed of the facts, would harbor concern that the biography factors are met? That it actually, you know, is the test that a reasonable observer would be concerned that there was some impact in this specific case that caused some specific outcome? Or is it just that out there, generally, something seems unfair about this process? In other words, do the biography factors apply at all in the apparent UCI context?
Your Honor, the standard is explained by Judge Ryan in the Hutchins case. She refers to the Lewis case. And she says, in my view, apparent unlawful command influence may be shown even without proof that the speaker intended the influence, even without proof that the speaker intended to influence a particular authority or that any authority was actually influenced. The focus of apparent lawful command influence is whether a reasonable, disinterested member of the public, fully informed of all the facts, would perceive the military justice system as fair. And that's Appelli's position, is that a disinterested member of the public, fully informed of all the facts, the context, the contextual facts in this case, would not find that the referral process was fair.
You mentioned the word lack of proof. Were you referring to the lack of proof for unlawful command influence, or the lack of proof in which the government had to bring the case to trial?
Your Honor, I'm referring to after the burden shifted to the government to prove there was no UCI beyond reasonable doubt, the government failed in their burden of proof there. That's what I was referring to.
Any other questions? You'd like to sum up?
Thank you, Your Honor. The military judge did not err in this case in finding that there was at least the appearance of unlawful command influence and did not err in dismissing the case without prejudice. Wherefore, the appellant respectfully requests that this court uphold the military judge's decision. Thank you.
Governor, would you like some rebuttal?
First, Your Honor, I'd like to just give you the site that I was talking about. When I was talking about a commander taking away discretion, what our court, our Superior Court has held, is falls into that category is U.S. v. Hawthorne, 22 CMR 83. And this is a case where a commanding general directed general court-martials for all those convicted with two previous convictions. So that's the case that I cited before. I want to make sure I got that in. Judge Weedy, your question regarding the what standard, the government's position is that there is a due process standard, and it was recently validated in U.S. v. Vasquez, and that's whether the accused alleged right is of such an extraordinary weighty factor as to overcome the balance struck by Congress. And if the due process, if the president is to fall under the Article 37, the only branch that can do that is Congress, because the statute is clear on its face, and thus it should fall under the due process analysis.
Okay. Well,
I think when the court is looking at allegations of due process violations, they're going to use the same framework. Now, what context the court will look at to determine if there is a due process violation would obviously include similar factors to what a UCI violation, because the facts that are in play are a commander, allegations of a commander influencing a proceeding. So the context would be the same, but the framework should be the due process framework from U.S. v. Vasquez.
Under a due process analysis concerning the president's remarks, do we have to, does the defense in that instance need to show that there was some actual harm in the proceedings, or is there an apparent UCI type of concern that is also addressed by a due process analysis?
I think when you're talking about, this is a similar situation when you're looking at pretrial publicity, and whether pretrial publicity has gotten to a point that it's overborne the appellant's or the accused's right to a fair trial. So I think it could be fall within the due process framework, the same, an allegation of apparent UCI. No, Your Honor, we're here to look at whether unlawful command, the judge's ruling about unlawful command influence and throwing out all the charges based on that alone was a valid ruling, and not whether the IO's evaluation of the evidence was somehow flawed.
But is that a consideration to determine whether the president's comments, the chief staff's comments, or other comments either caused caused the children to continue burden bearing and children to be unlawful to manual abortions caused by parents. How do we evaluate that in case of burden referral?
I fail to see how the evidence for a simple assault would be part of this evaluation, especially when the aggravated sexual assault charge was dropped before referral. So I don't see how the, I just don't see how it would come into this court's purview with this particular issue.
The question is, would we be here if we're not for the unlawful, alleged unlawful influence? Isn't the weight of the evidence in the charge relevant? If there's very weak evidence, wouldn't that tend to suggest that maybe, the comments may have had some influence on the decision made by the community?
Well, in this case, there's no UCI alleged to the Article 32. So that hasn't even been raised with regard to what the investigator found.
But doesn't it relate, doesn't it possibly relate to the motivations of the convening authority? If the case presents very weak evidence substantively, is that something that we can consider in deciding whether the President's comments or the Chief of Staff's comments influence the convening authority?
The pre-referral and referral in this case was in strict compliance with the UCMJ. The referral specifically was in compliance with 601. And the general looked at the evidence and decided to refer certain charges. Whether the assault charges were weak when we're looking at whether...
Well, let's not talk about the assault charge. Let's talk about the underlying sexual assault charge. And the IO had, we have in the record before us, very detailed comments about the complaining witness's credibility. Can we consider her credibility and the overall strength of the case in total in deciding whether the convening authority was influenced by these statements?
No, Your Honor, because that would be getting, we haven't even gotten to trial yet. So we're talking about the Article 32 investigation. We have to next get to trial where an actual military judge or a panel members will look at this evidence and decide if the accused is guilty.
Counsel,
or not.
Yeah, I asked a lot of the defense counsel this, and I want to stick on it, and I think it's the same play here. We're looking at were the proceedings here fair, and when the defense has to prove the proceedings were unfair. But you look at the collective experience of the court up here, and you look at the charge in this case, charges, and you have this allegation from this victim. I mean, would we be in court 2-3 years ago with these charges? Would we have recommended an Article 32 hearing, and then after receiving this report and with the IO's comments here, would we recommend to a convening authority to go to court, proceed to court on these charges if we didn't have this aura of comments from everybody on sexual assault?
Absolutely, Your Honor, we would. In this case, there was a referral commander who looked at the evidence, swore that he believed the offenses to be committed. It was sent to an independent IO, and that person forwarded on his take on the evidence and his recommendations. The general followed those recommendations. I don't see how the standard for sexual assault, unless we're talking about the fact that 120 changed, the standard for sexual assault has been the same. If it's been committed, it should be charged and the person should go to court-martial to see if they're guilty or not.
Unless there's UCI. Unless one of those convening authorities or the referral authority was so afraid of the comments of the President, the Chief of Staff, or even Congress that they said, I wouldn't normally do this, but I don't want my career ruined.
But you have to have the evidence of that, Your Honor, that is assuming that the commander's will is overborne.
Well, that's what the defense is arguing. The apparent comments of that, like that, coupled with what this court looks like could be very weak evidence to go forward on a case, seems to imply that this was only brought forward because people were concerned about themselves and not the state of the evidence. Isn't that a fair thing for this court to consider with regard to whether UCI has actually taken place?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time if I could answer. Okay.
Sure.
Yes. Your Honor, when looking at whether this is UCI, in Lawrence v. Ayers, our Supreme Court held it did not meet their burden. They did not meet their burden when the Secretary of Defense said, weed out sex offenders. When the Secretary of the Army said, if violations occurred, we will hold the perpetrators accountable. We will expose them and eradicate them. And a local spokesman for the base stated to a local newspaper that disciplinary action in Appellant's case could range from a reprimand to a general court-martial, but in the lower end of the range is probably not going to be considered. This was before the Article 32 was completed. If in that case, that the UCI command influence alleged in the air did not connect to that appellant's case, then it certainly does not connect in this case, where none of these comments were about the appellant.
I just want to make sure I understood one of your answers correctly. Like I had asked your opponent there, you know, the sort of core of the issue is, or the argument is, whether or not we'd be in court if the referral authority hadn't been pressured, right? But I understood you to say that in our analysis of whether, in the analysis we conduct to try and assess whether or not that two-star was pressured, we may not consider the Article 32 IO's observations about the victim's credibility.
I don't think it's relevant for your findings. I think that when you're looking at whether the commander was...
Is it not part of the evidence that a referral authority is, excuse me, allowed to consider? When your Article 32 IO says, hey, here's the evidence you got, but it's really weak.
If the allegation somehow, the evidence was tied to the UCI, if there was a set of circumstances where the evidence was tied to the USI, the UCI, then that may be appropriate. Otherwise, it's just going outside the scope. It's just, defense didn't even raise that issue in this case.
Well, it's just not trying to.
Kevin, I think the question is, if you have a very weak case that makes allegations of an Article 120 sex offense, and then you have that coming through the process, through referral, through the Article 32 investigation, gets the referral commander, who has also heard the president say, sexual offenses will be court-martialed. Isn't that the evidence that UCI influenced its decision to refer this to a general court-martial as opposed to taking some other action?
No, Your Honor, because that would be usurping the commander's role and the role of the court-martial. Weak evidence is not no evidence. So I just think that would be injecting this court, the appellate court, into a process that hasn't even gotten to adjudication yet.
All right, would you like to sum up?
Yes. In conclusion, Your Honors, our Superior Court stated in Simpson, when members of the public entrust their sons and daughters to the military training process, they expect to receive accurate and complete information about the quality of training, of the training environment, including the state of discipline. This applies to the military overall, and that is what the President and the Chief of Staff did here and no more. There was no evidence of UCI. The General exercised his independent discretion in not referring all the charges. This court must overturn this military judge's ruling and allow the military justice system to work as endorsed by our Superior Court. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both sides for your informative and spirited argument today. We will take this case under advisement and we will render a decision in due course. We are adjourned.